You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Indeed Sponsored Jobs. If you're hiring for your organisation, Indeed is all you need. Spend more time interviewing candidates who tick all of your boxes with less stress, less time spent sifting through the applications, and better results by using Indeed Sponsored Jobs. Listeners to the Cycling Podcast will get a £100 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves. Just go to indeed.com/cycle. Now, why does Indeed Sponsored Jobs give you the edge when it comes to recruiting the best quality candidates for your company? Well, first of all, it will help your job ad stand out from the crowd. It will help you to attract people based on the criteria that you're looking for. And it will help you sift through all of those applicants so that you can narrow down to a really targeted shortlist of people that you want to interview. And ultimately, you'll be able to hire the best possible person for your team. So go to indeed.com/cycle right now, and you'll be supporting the Cycling Podcast by saying that you heard about Indeed on the podcast. That's indeed.com/cycle. Terms and conditions apply. If you're hiring, do it the right way with Indeed. Now it's on with the show.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello, and joining you after a week when Paul Sixas proved that you really can find anything you need at Decathlon. Canoes, javelins, fishing, tackle, and it turns out the legs to beat Juan Ayuso and João Almeida up Portuguese mountain. My name is Daniel Freeber, and I'm the host of this episode of the Cycling Podcast, in which we'll discuss the enfant prodige of French cycling's Pogacar surpassing exploits in Portugal, the feats of another phenom in the UAE Tour, and what's in store at Omloop Het Nieuwsblad this weekend with a detour via Kortrijk Corner. Yes, it's back. Joining me to do all of that today, someone who's accompanied me on many visits to Decathlon over the years, it's Rob Hatch.
Hello, I'm only here for Kortrijk Corner, by the way, no Decathlon visits, I'm not bothered about them.
Rob, I propose the next time we go in, whether it's in Palma de Mallorca or another branch of Decathlon, we ask one of the always very accessible and amenable sales assistants whether we can have some sex-ass legs. Also with us today, possibly loitering somewhere in the archery aisle, looking at crossbows or eyeing up a new kendo uniform, it's Lionel Burney.
Hello, Daniel. Well, Graham Wilgos and I went in a Decathlon during the Tour de France last year to buy our tents for our ill-fated camping expedition on Mont Ventoux. We also bought some mattresses and pillows, all sorts of stuff in there. A great place for camping equipment. So, you know, Paul Sixas could probably do a sort of training camp in the Alps without having to go to a hotel. He could just camp with all Decathlon's fantastic equipment. Now, this is starting to sound like a Decathlon advert.
Well, how the bloody hell have we not got sponsorship from Decathlon?
I mean,
I have sung their praises almost as much as my soft drink of choice, Rivella, from Switzerland over the years. And yeah, nothing. Not a peep out of those chaps.
Monsieur 10%, don't we, to get have a word with them.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, they're getting a good ROI on the cycling team at the moment, aren't they? Return on investment. They're one of the most winningest teams of the season so far, aren't they?
Yeah,
doing very well across all fronts.
Not as much talk yet, and that's logical because it is early. It's the first year of the relegation cycle. Of course, we spent so much time talking about that at the end of last year, but I did actually have a glance at the UCI rankings earlier on this morning, just to see how things are shaping up. And Decathlon are indeed, they're doing pretty well. They're fifth in the standings. They're sort of the top, what we would imagine to be the big five of congregating at the top of the rankings, with one big exception. Down in 15th place, Team Visma Lisa bike. They could do with a result.
And Astana have started, in Europe.
Yeah, and Astana have started like a house on fire again. They're second. They're becoming the sort of February specialists, aren't they? Chaps, lots to discuss this week, lots of racing. We're going to recap UAE Tour, Algarve, and the exploits of Mr. Sixas, and Ruta del Sol as well, which you were commentating on. We're going to preview Omloop Het Nieuwsblad with a couple of notable contributions, one of them already mentioned. But before we get onto all of that, a couple of news items we wanted to mention. Giro wildcards, chaps, no real surprises there. Two UCI Pro Teams qualified by ranking 2025. That's Pinarello, Q36.5, Tom Pidcock's team, and Tudor, and the Motown Maestro, Lucky Larry Warbass. He was on the podcast last week. His team, they're both riding the Giro. Larry's also down to ride the Giro. And three to traditional wild cards sort of selected by RCS. Bardiani, CSF, they are always at the Giro, of course, pretty much. Team Polter, Visit Malta, pretty much these days, always at the Giro. And Unibet Rose Rockets, the Dutch, as Christian Prudhomme was at pains to stress. Not French team. They will also be riding another French team. They will be riding Unibet Rose Rockets. That'll be their first Grand Tour. Big moment for them. A French team that won't be riding is Cofidis, who had qualified but have opted out.
That helps the organisers, doesn't it? Because it means that they can continue to invite both the Italian teams and another team. And one curious thing about that set of announcements means that basically every team in cycling's top 30 teams last season, every team that qualified for a Grand Tour invite has won somewhere this year. So that, I would say, in a time of pretty dire, you know, we're always hearing that cycling's in dire straits economically and it's not good for teams. Every single team that was eligible to ride a Grand Tour in 2026 gets to ride at least one.
Big season for Pinarello Q36.5 as well, though, because they now have the complete set to go for the Giro, the Tour and the Vuelta. And it's going to mean some big opportunities for some of the riders on that roster. I mean, I'm not saying it tails off after Tom Pidcock, but Tom Pidcock is the big, big star. And you can only imagine he's going to ride two of the three, right? He's not going to do all three. He's not going to do Marino Lajareta and ride all three.
I can imagine he won't go near the Giro given his spring plan. And of course, to focus on the Tour de France, I imagine it's going to be Tour and Vuelta for him.
Absolutely. Yeah.
He didn't have a very good time at the particularly good time at the Giro last year either. Talking of the Giro d'Italia, we know that Jonas Vingegaard has made the Giro his first big objective of the season. Of course, he had that crash in training a few weeks ago and pulled out of, which race did he pull out of, chaps? Remind me.
UAE Tour.
He has rejigged his program. We wondered, and we've seen this before with Vingegaard, when he has crashed or he's left races early. Was it Paris-Nice last year that he crashed out of? And he didn't then insert another race into his program. We wondered whether he might, and he didn't. And we wondered, similarly, this year, after his crash in training and having to skip the UAE Tour, whether there would be an addition to his program, because his next outing was due to be in Catalunya at the end of March. And he has indeed added another race to his program, and that is Paris-Nice, which starts in just over a week, doesn't it? Not surprising, I suppose. That team is also, they've talked in the media about having a title to defend, of course. Matteo Jorgensen has won the last two editions of Paris-Nice. He's not going to be there. He's going to be at Tirreno Adriatico. So they're going to have Vingegaard on a course which probably doesn't suit him as well as maybe the last few editions of Paris-Nice. But nonetheless, he'll be one of the favourites, won't he?
Before we move on, can I mention a curious one? We don't really do social media anymore, do we? It's a kind of a wasteland these days, isn't it? Owned by billionaires. You're frowning there, Daniel. But I did notice that 2018 Tour de France winner Geraint Thomas was using Twitter, or X as we must now call it, as a sort of customer service platform.
Yeah.
Have you seen this?
No, but do you know what? Go first.
Well, basically, he was asking Air France for some assistance after having presumably had a frustrating experience with their customer service. He's, you know, emailing them, perhaps calling them. And Air France replied to call him Thomas. remember when he was registered with the UCI as a professional rider, he was curiously, his name was registered kind of the wrong way around, wasn't it? So often race captions on TV that were just taking the data from the UCI's website or the race organizer, often he got misnamed Thomas Geraint instead of Geraint Thomas. And then there's obviously lots of people saying, come on, Air France, you should know that Geraint Thomas won the Maillot Jaune, the Tour de France. You're big national event. Air France haven't really covered themselves in glory there, but I suppose if they've lost his luggage or they've messed up his flight booking or whatever, kind of par for the course, I guess.
Is it really Air France or is it AI Air France?
The UCI often make those mistakes, don't they, with, or they have been known to make those mistakes with graphics. I remember for a few years at the start of their respective careers, Mathias Norgaard and Matteo Jorgensen were mixed up. I can't remember how they were mixed up, but they were definitely mixed up.
There's other riders who get middle names inserted in, and obviously they filled out the paperwork with their middle name. So Simon Phillip Yates, yeah. Hugh John Carthy, I think it was. So you'd often see, it's often British riders, wasn't it? And maybe just very diligent with the paperwork. Mm. Well done, lads.
Hugh Carthy, that's a subject for another day. That's a subject for a deep dive indeed. Just on the Air France thing, Napalm, I saw that tweet. And I don't know whether directly above it, there was a tweet about Paul Seixas, or it was just, I saw that tweet after Seixas had done something in Algarve. And it occurred to me that that might be, I'd been served on a plate, maybe the first contender for Paul Seixas' nickname, Air France. But then it occurred to me that Air France probably has a terrible reputation in France. I've never had a negative experiences with Air France. In fact, it seems it's quite a prestigious brand in my eyes, in my thoughts, but maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
Air France, anyway. Could go down a rabbit warren here, couldn't we? Which cycling team is, I don't know, Wizz Air? who's the Ryanair of cycling? Anyway, look, we've got an all-you-can-eat buffet of stage races to discuss, so should we do that in the next part?
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
This episode of the cycling podcast is brought to you by BICMO Cycle Insurance, because let's face it, things happen. Whether it's a crash landing, the heartbreak of a stolen bike, or the ultimate facepalm moment of reversing over your prized aero wheel, BICMO has you covered. Flexible policies that you can cancel anytime, 50% off extra bikes in your household, protection for your kit, race entries, and even damage while travelling to your next epic ride. They've thought of it all. And here's the thing, BICMO isn't some faceless insurance company. They're all bike riders too, with a shared mission to protect the world's riders and the places we ride. So when you insure with them, you're not just getting great coverage, you're joining a community that gets what it means to love cycling. So whether you're smashing sprints, grinding climbs, or just enjoying a Sunday spin, ride safe. BICMO's got your back. Protect your ride before it's too late. Head to BICMO.com to get covered. That's BICMO.com. Flexible policies. Cancel any time. Terms apply. Check your policy docs.
Well, to borrow the joke just served to me by Rob, before we recommence recording, we're flying first class into part two. Rob, you've always struck me as having the air of a kind of airline pilot. I can imagine you in that vein, sort of appearing out of the cockpit and announcing to the passengers that we'd been diverted via Beauvais as opposed to Paris.
Until I was about 17, 18 is what
I know this story. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. I was going to study physics and maths and all that, and then change to languages in that sort of common, not very straight line change.
Well, Rob, air transport's loss was cycling commentary's gain. And we will be flying.
Very reassuring voice, Rob. I think if you came across, you know, hello, this is Rob Hatch, captain speaking, would you do it with the commentary voice or with the Lancashire voice? That's the question.
Commentary voice. It's like when you're a kid. That's just where the commentary voice came from. You know, like when you phone a takeaway. But he did in Lancashire anyway.
Yeah, you know, he's gone really Lancashire now. Suddenly.
Yeah, yeah, but you phone him, can I order some food, please? And your sort of telephone voice comes on, doesn't it? I guess that's where it comes from.
Anyway, chaps, to the Iberian Peninsula, to the westernmost point of the, or well, southern westernmost point of the Iberian Peninsula and the Volta ao Algarve. In Portugal, we debated briefly which race should come first in order of which of the races, few stage races took place last week, should come first in order of importance. Prestige, according to the UCI rankings, of course, UAE Tour was the most prestigious stage race that took place last year that has World Tour status. But the best field really was in Portugal on the Algarve. I mean, we talked about the UCI rankings points a few weeks ago and the shameful attribution of points for stage wins in 2-point pro stage races, and given the field in Algarve, 25 points for a stage win, pretty scandalous. But in terms of the sort of future, short-term future, mid-term future, maybe long-term future of the sport, I would suggest to you that stage victory in Algarve was very significant because of who won the stages. One in particular, we recorded with Larry last week. It was on the day of, was it stage two or stage three? It was the first of two mountaintop finishes, this one to Alto da Foia, which is a traditional haunt of the Volta Algarve. But on this occasion, the race went up a different way to the usual way, much harder way, and therefore it was pretty significant. And who won? Paul Sexas, future 24-time Tour de France winner, Paul Sexas of Decathlon, already discussed. And then that set up a bit of a clash of the titans, similar to the one we would have in the UAE on the penultimate day in UAE, and it was on the final day in Algarve, between Sexas and Juan Ayuso, with a few sort of interlopers as well. A few people that intruded on that battle. But it was Juan Ayuso that won the day there on Alto do Malau. And he also took the general classification. And that victory for Ayuso, I would suggest to you chaps, has been slightly overshadowed by Sexas's remarkable exploits. Maybe overshadowed in my mind because I've consumed more sort of French-speaking media since last week. And I've mentioned, well, I mentioned last week on the podcast or a couple of weeks ago that the RMC, which is the big French podcast, French radio station, they do a podcast. I sort of rechristened that the Sex Cast. It's the only Sex Cast on my algorithm. But that is all they talk about. All they talk about every week now is Paul Sexas. So they've been going crazy about Sexas's performance in Algarve. But rightly so, I would suggest.
Definitely. I mean, I'm sure you guys touched on this last week, but, you know, winning Alto da Foia, there's a certain Mr. Pogacar who had his first professional win there, and Sixas was actually a year younger than when Tadej Pogacar won that. The only difference being that Pogacar went on to take the overall later that week and take that. But again, there was a matter of seconds in this. Yes, Ayuso was on fantastic form, wasn't he, when he won his stage on the final day. He was great in the time trial as well. But, I mean, the way we were talking about Ayuso 3 or 4 years ago, Sixas is actually coming along younger than Ayuso was and backing it up before Ayuso was. And I think that's the big difference.
Funnily enough, Remco also won when he was 20 on Alto da Foia.
Yeah, good indicator, isn't it? And it's a race that lots of big-name riders have won. Team Sky kind of rejuvenated it in a way, didn't they, by sort of taking it quite seriously in the sort of 2015-16-17. I think Geraint Thomas won it at one point. But yeah, the Sexas hype train, I mean, this is his first proper, if I can put it that way, proper professional win, because he won the Tour de l'Avenir last year, as expected. But that's a race for under 25s, is it? And it's not under 23s, is it? Well, I can't remember what the cutoff point is. But there's been a lot of talk about Sexas's development, largely as a result of the way he rode in the European Championships road race, especially late summer. And to see him get his first victory, although I didn't actually see it myself because the TV coverage cut away with a couple of kilometres to go and they went to the football, which I think, considering it was Newcastle United against Carabag in the Europa League, I think they missed the big story of the sporting day.
Also, Lionel, on the actual was the feed that went out everywhere, and it was so, if you were streaming on your phone, you would have seen this, that about 20 metres from the line, you sort of saw the inside of someone's sleeve, which I sort of hopefully suggested was maybe the inside of someone's Decathlon rain jacket. I think the camera operator had a few issues keeping up with Air France as he zeroed in on his first win. But extremely impressive, wasn't it? I mean, we've glibly talked about the hype around Sexas. I don't know if you, Rob, you've already made clear that you didn't listen to last week's podcast. But anyway, Larry and I did have a discussion last week about, we were talking about Andrew August, actually, at Ineos, and how he'd been sort of given this poison chalice of this incredible billing by a coach a few years ago who said that he was like Remco, but with a bigger VO2 max or more power. And I'd said to Larry that this can be, you know, very dangerous for a young rider. But Sexas at the moment, he seems very sort of unfazed by all of the inevitable hype. Larry mentioned last week that he thought there was a key difference between riders that come from outside Europe very, very young and are sort of left to find their own way and also sort of learn how to live on their own, fend for themselves in Europe. And they're much more exposed in terms of hype and overhype than maybe someone like Sexas, who's still living with his parents. And Decathlon seems to be taking this all pretty seriously and doing the right things. They've now given him his own press officer. I don't know if you chaps remember Dominique Isartel, who used to write for L'Equipe, is working, I think, this season as his press officer. Sexas's parents were in Algarve watching the race. Interestingly, on the issue of press media relations, he also seems to be pretty clued up. I mean, my dealings with him last year, there was this sort of youthful spontaneity about him, and he's very engaging, he speaks good English, and he's sort of mediagenic, I would say. But it's funny, in Portugal, I noticed that there was, he got one question about whether he felt like he was, he knew how to be a patron. And obviously, this is a loaded term because Bernard Hinault, of course, last French winner of the Tour de France, was known as le patron, the boss. And it seemed as though Sexas's antenna was sort of buzzing, and he sort of skillfully, artfully avoided that question. Another question that he's skillfully avoiding, or straight batting, is the question, the big question about the Tour de France: is he doing it or not? So he seems to have pretty good advice on that front at the moment.
Yeah, what's interesting is that he's got a race program that looks like it's going to be sort of big races, and maybe Itzulia in between some of the one day races that are on his calendar. So he's going to be exposed to some high level racing in the next couple of months. And I suspect, you know, the final decision about whether to expose him to the Tour de France at the age, well, he'll still be 19, won't he? With all of that expectation and hype, that question doesn't need to be answered now in February, does it? Decathlon can take their time. They can see how the whole of the rest of the team goes and monitor his progress. And I would suggest, and I think we said this at the end of last year, probably got less to lose by giving him early exposure to the Tour de France than by holding him off, really. I mean, We've seen it in the past, haven't we? Riders who go in, I mean, a very different era, very different riders. But, you know, Alejandro Valverde was the kind of the big star 21 years ago and did 10 days of the Tour, I think, won a stage before he pulled out of the race. And it was kind of, you know, a way to give him, well, half a Grand Tour's experience, and but not burn him out, not wear him out. I think Sexas has to be aware of the fact that the hype train is going to, you know, accelerate. And once the kind of the general public in France know who he is and become aware that they might have somebody very special coming along, that expectation from kind of the everyday French society and media is going to ramp up, which is going to be the bigger thing to deal with than the kind of the expectation within the team and within cycling in general, I think.
Let's say he has a couple of years where he makes his Grand Tour debut at the Vuelta and he wins a stage or two, something like that. He finishes, I don't know, top five GC or even on the podium, like a young Pogacar did. Then he wins, I don't know, a Bahinis, something like that. You imagine the expectation of him going to make his Tour de France debut then.
Yeah, I think
it was the question I was going to pose to you guys, actually. And Lionel, you've just given us your answer. I think it's a really good shout. And think of where the team is now as well, because it's obvious in the next couple of years, this is a team with a big budget. They're going to start to build a team around him, if they can keep him, that is. But now you've got the likes of Gal, you've got Podomo, had a brilliant season last season. Other people, you know, who can climb can do their bit. Bernard's going to miss the Classic, so he's going to come in probably for the summer. You've got a really solid team with other people who can do other things, and not everything is about Paul's success. So I think it is a great time to put him in.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, that his age and everyone, I think everyone's understanding that this is sort of exceptional. I think that is a good caveat. And that does maybe take a little bit of pressure off. So if it does go badly, then everyone will have that excuse for him on his behalf. And we've seen this before. You know, Mark Cavendish did the 2007 Tour de France. He struggled really, and he only did 10 days. It didn't affect the rest of his career. And then in recent past, and this brings us back to Algarve and the winner of Algarve, Juan Ayuso did the Vuelta a España and finished on the podium when he was 19. Just on his next races, the hype train, this is sex us, the hype train may accelerate further this weekend because he's riding the Forn Ardèche Classic, and that is on the same course pretty much as the European Championships, which is a big breakout race at the end of last year. Rob, did you want to?
Yeah, no, I was going to say that would accelerate in France, but let's be honest, with opening weekend, I would say that most international cycling fans' attention will be on Belgium on it this weekend. The headline will be there. No, don't listen to the podcast, obviously.
The sex cast and the cycling podcast will be cranking it up next week, don't you worry. We'll be going big on Forn Ardèche. And just back, before we move on, back to Ayuso, as I said, he was sort of overshadowed. Another thing I wanted to mention about sex cast, the thing that most impressed me about him last week was probably his time trial and how close he came to... who won the time trial? Who won the time trial? Ganna, wasn't it?
Philippe Ganna.
But yeah, so he sort of overshadowed Ayuso, but it was a sort of exemplary performance, not only by Ayuso, but also by Little Trek. And it was interesting in the interview that Ayuso gave after the final stage, how magnanimous he was about his teammates and what a brilliant job they had done. And that was obvious that they had done a great job. But it struck me that Little Trek is a team with a very strong team ethic, more so than what we've heard consistently from various riders over the last couple of years about UAE Team Emirates, is that they are a team that sort of unashamedly, like, they lean into their individuals' abilities. And we've even heard that there are times when the tactics are a little bit sort of fast and loose before races, and it's a case of, well, you know, you have a go, may the best man win. And maybe Juan Ayuso, this whole narrative about Juan Ayuso being very selfish and individualistic, maybe he wasn't helped by where he was as a rider. If he's got a team that is very much focused on him, then maybe we'll start to see him sort of reciprocate some of what he's receiving from his teammates. And this narrative that he's very selfish, maybe it will fade, hopefully for him.
He rode well though, didn't he, all week? And like you say, the team was there with him. I thought the final stage where he was in control, really, wasn't he? Oscar Onley making his debut for Ineos Grenadiers. We did speculate a couple of weeks ago when that would be, and I probably should have thought that it would make perfect sense for him to ride in Algarve because it's a race that Team Sky back in the day has done very well in. Onley looked really good as well, but he went just that little bit too early, and Ayuso was kind of patient. And although he had the overall classification wrapped up at that point, you know, he wanted to take the stage win as well, and just was able to bide his time and get it just on the line. I thought it was quite a mature ride by Ayuso there. And as you say, Daniel, you know, the UAE Tour, the higher ranked race, and therefore the one with more points on offer, and I suppose more important. But there were a lot of little stories here, weren't there? The debut of Onley that I've just mentioned. Philippe Ganna winning the time trial. Of course, last year, he was kind of robbed of a stage win on the opening day, wasn't he? When half the peloton was sent the wrong way at the finish and there were two winners, and then they just decided not to award anybody a victory. So he came back. And quite a nice course that, and down into Villamora, Luis Figo's old haunt, isn't it? The former Barcelona and Real Madrid player.
Yeah, Rob. I've played golf there a few times.
Very nice.
It's a very, very posh resort, isn't it? Right in the centre of the Algarve. Lovely, lovely place. Yeah,
When I was there, I felt...
A lot of boat people around.
I felt really out of place. I felt even more kind of slovenly and scruffy than I usually do.
and one more story from that race as well. You talked about that finish in Lagos. We're talking about one French star, aren't we? But what about Paul Meunier? Because he got Soudal Quick-Step's first wins of the season.
Yeah.
Classics are coming up. I mean, he's another young French talent, albeit an American-born French talent.
Yeah, I mean, His record since last summer is absolutely extraordinary. It may be the most extraordinary run of victories that we've ever, well, we've certainly seen in the last 20, 30 years or so. He's won of the last 32 races he's done, he's won over half of them, which is partly a reflection on maybe the standard of some of those races at the end of last year. And this year he'll be doing harder races, but it's still pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, he had a tricky Giro, didn't he, last year, Daniel? I remember, I think, in Napoli, the disastrous day in Napoli, where it was kind of a skid pan, wasn't it, the finish, and they some sprinted, some didn't. He was third over the line there. But like you say, it was, I think, the biggest races that he did in that run in the second half of last year, the Tour de Pologne, Tour of Poland. He won a stage there, didn't win anything at the Renewi Tour. I still think of that as the Eneco Tour. But yes, Slovakia, Croatia, Guangxi, of course, finished the season with a streak of wins there. And with Omloop Nieuwsblad coming up at the weekend, he was second there last year. And he's in a Soudal Quickstep team, which is going to basically pivot pretty hard back towards the classics, and we'll talk about that in the next part. But to get those two wins in, well, the only two opportunities, and he took them both, bodes well. Because, you know, there was Jasper Philipsen, there was Dalee, there was Ackermann, there was Caden Groves, there was Jordi Meus. You know, this wasn't kind of winning against nobody. This was winning against, you know, some really good sprinters, Grand Tour stage winners. A very promising start for Manier. And I think that bodes well for him and Soudal Quickstep at the weekend. Although Omloop Nieuwsblad will be tricky, because I think the finish might be a little bit different this year. But we'll talk about that in the next bit.
Yeah, Manier's due to do the Giro again. That's probably on the proviso that Tim Merlier recovers from his current issues, because he is Soudal's, well, anointed sprinter for the Tour de France.
But significant knee problem that's going to rule him out of the most of the classics that he would have done, I think. You know, we don't know when we'll see him next. Anyway, we should probably head back to the desert, which feels like we're going back on ourselves.
Yeah, let's head to the desert. I mentioned this great showdown on the final day between Sexas and Ayuso in Portugal, where we had a similar thing. We sort of set it up last year in the podcast with Larry. At that point, we'd had the stage to Jebel Mobra, this extraordinary sort of Zonkalan of the Gulf, where Antonio Tiberi had caused a surprise, and he had won that stage, and Isaac del Toro had finished second, and that put Tiberi 21 seconds ahead of Del Toro before what was going to be the final showdown, another mountaintop finish, more familiar one to Jebel Hafit. 21 seconds. I said to Larry, I thought that Del Toro would struggle to claw back 21 seconds. Larry disagreed. He thought Del Toro would do it easily. I wouldn't say he did it easily. Tiberi hung on pretty bravely, but in the last 3 kilometres, Del Toro did finally pull away, and he ended up beating Tiberi by 31 seconds on that stage. And that left us with the final GC of Del Toro winning, Tiberi 20 seconds down, and Luke Plapp, who's on excellent form, rode really well on the stage of Jebel Hafit. In particular, he was third, 1:14 down. Way down in 10th place was Remco Evenepoel, 2:25 down. So overall, we'd had 2 stage wins for Del Toro, 3 stage wins for Jonathan Milan, who completely dominated the sprints. And of course, earlier in the week, we'd had the time trial that was won by Remco Evenepoel. That was the only bright note, really, for him of last week in UAE. He said he felt he didn't feel as good as he had done in the previous weeks. Of course, he'd had a sort of rip-roaring start to the season. He felt a little bit tired.
There was all sorts going on, though. I mean, the excuses were coming out, weren't there? There was the aircon not working. There was the alarm clock going off in his room. There were a few things that came out. And we didn't quite get the sort of meltdown that we maybe predicted in March, if that comes. But it was a very different week for Remco, wasn't it? After all of the brilliant, you know, success he had earlier on. I did have a look at the start list quality of the races that Evenepoel won earlier in the season, compared to the UAE Tour, and there was a considerable difference. Maybe a bit of food for thought for Red Bull. It will be. They'll be wondering how he can get back on sort of stage racing. And whether it was a bad week, whether he was ill, and if that is the case, they'll know, won't they? Because they'll be monitoring his physical condition, and they won't be so worried about that. But if it is something else, then there might be little tweaks. And let's remember, getting on new staff, getting on new teams, and you know, on both sides, they'll be tweaking things as they go along, won't they?
It was a surprise, though. It was a surprise. I mean, you know, yes, I take the point about the quality of the field in Mallorca and Valencia being lower, but he was racing with such kind of aggression, really on the front foot, really taking things on. And I fully expected after the time trial, again, not unexpected that he would win that. But then he looked just a bit like out of gas, didn't he? It wasn't like there was really any fight there. And I did wonder whether it was a case of, look, I don't feel this. I'm not going to put myself into difficulty. It's only the UAE tour. It's not that important. So keeping an eye on the bigger picture. He's in a very different situation to Isaac Del Toro as well. And I guess Tiberi, you know, he's not really won you know, anything as big as this before, has he? I mean, you know, he's been there or thereabouts, but, you know, that was a pretty big win for Tiberi. But I just wanted to roll back to the opening day of UAE. I know you and Larry talked about this last week, Daniel, but Isaac Del Toro succeeded exactly where Tadej Pogacar didn't last year. Do you remember we were recording the podcast whilst the first stage of UAE Tour was finishing, and Pogacar kind of took that flyer on that sort of slightly uphill sprint finish and was overhauled by Jonathan Milan on day one of UAE last year. This year, Del Toro did the same move, but was helped by the fact that Milan had been involved in a crash earlier, so wasn't there. But it was quite interesting to see the same template being deployed by Del Toro, and he saw it through. And I did think that, you know, he looked a bit vulnerable on Jebel Mobrak, but kind of did come roaring back, really. I thought, it wasn't like, you know, completely without doubt, but he did ride very well on Jebel Hafit. Again, patient, no panic. When he wasn't quite in the right position, he clawed his way back and finished it off very well. I thought it was a very impressive week for him.
Yeah, it was. I mean, we talked last week in the podcast about why Del Toro approaches climbs the way he does, and he sort of Almeida'd Jebel Mobra. And we also talked about sort of Remco. Why is it that Remco, there seems to be almost a disparity between the power that Remco can put out over sort of 30 minutes and his performances in mountain stages recently. I mean, I thought that I saw some stats, I think it was from Velon, about the Del Toro, the sort of fatal attack for Tiberi. They said it lasted 69 seconds, his final attack on Jebel Hafit of Del Toro, 69 seconds in which his average, Tiberi's average was 610 watts. And this was fatal because Tiberi couldn't hold it, and then he blew. And then one of his direct supporters, Franco Pellizzotti, said in an interview with Bici Pro, Italian site, that he did 1 minute too many sort of in the red. And this is kind of what we talked about with Larry last week with regards to Remco. And, you know, is it a question of when he goes into the red, then he struggles to sort of reel it back more than maybe other riders. But yeah, difficult to argue with Del Toro's approach, certainly. Well, it won out in the end. I mean, it was pretty tense, that battle up Jebel Hafit. It looked at one point, especially as the attack sort of came, and this often happens, doesn't it, as the gradients eased. And we know on that climb, there's a point where the road goes pretty flat, I don't know, it's a sort of false flat. And it was there, really, that he landed the coup de grace, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's funny, actually. We mentioned Paul Magnier, didn't we, a minute ago, and record since last Giro. I mean, Del Toro's record since last Giro is nothing short of phenomenal. So that Giro d'Italia stage he won, I think it was in Bormio, wasn't it? 17th stage. That was his fifth career victory. Del Toro now is 24. Mm. Since the end of the Giro d'Italia last year, he's taken 19 wins. It's absolutely incredible. That's more than most sprinters have in a period in their lives. This is sort of, I know they're not Pogacar level races, all of them yet, but they're Pogacar numbers, those, aren't they? They're absolutely incredible. So yeah, I mean, I think that Del Toro deserves a lot of credit for how he dealt with that climb. Let's also say, I mean, he did have a brilliant UAE tour team backing him up. Adam Yates doing what Adam Yates does when he's in that domestique mode, just dragging the group back. And while we're on the subject of that stage and the UAE, I was lucky enough to be commentating with Steve Cummins last week, who now works for Jake Arlulo as a sports director. And he was really excited watching Luke Platt climbing up towards the end there. Platt finishing on the podium on that race is a superb performance and certainly gives, I think, Jake Arlulo some thought as to what they can do. If they can strike that formula to get Platt consistent and performing over, let's say, week-long stage races first, not just because a Grand Tour is difficult, isn't it? But if you can do that over a week, he can win a week-long stage race.
His problem, though, and I think he's been quite transparent about this, is that he's very good on hockey stick stages, Unipuerto stages, one climb, and as soon as there are two or three climbs, then he struggles. And he struggles not least with positioning as well. We've seen that many times. Rob, you commentated on Ruta there, so there's something I also want to talk about. Marc Soler, another UAE rider, but let's do that. We'll clean up the racing first. We'll go to Ruta del Sol and then we'll revisit UAE and Marc Soler.
Okay, Ruta del Sol, Vuelta Andalucía. Strange old race, wasn't it, this year in terms of the parkour? Turning up, I was on Winter Olympics duty mainly in the last couple of weeks, but I was during the day able to watch a lot of the racing and commentate on the Vuelta Andalucía from the studio. And I sort of turned up, having mainly covered the Algarve for the best, I don't know, last 10 years of my career. So I hadn't done Vuelta Andalucía for a long time in a work capacity. And I sort of didn't really understand what the race was in terms of which of the difficult stages. The last stage had that climb, and descent into a finish. They were all beautifully presented stages, I should say. It really showed off the interior of Andalusia beautifully. We got to see a lot of olive groves, a lot of small towns in the hills and the mountains, away from the costas and all that sort of stuff. It was a really, really nice place. And I already made a note of a few places that I'd like to visit, actually, in Andalusia, because I haven't been for quite a while. It was good looking. I mean, racing-wise, the headline was Pidcock, wasn't he? He was going there after a decent start in Murcia, the sort of Murcia, not Murcia, that did and didn't happen at the same time. Marc Soler winning that one, and I know you're going to come on to that in a minute, Daniel. Then he was second in Jaén in the Clásica there, which is a race that really suits Pidcock, and you imagine you'll see him winning that at some point. And again, but how would he approach this race? We had sort of this reduced bunch sprint on the first day with Christophe Laporte. Really good story for Visma. He was back winning a Pro Series race, a second division race, for the first time in a couple of years after all of his illness and injury. And then the second day was a strange old day. Ivan Bromeo was out in the breakaway. Andreas Leknesen was with him. Two strong riders. And they were given sort of three and a half, almost 4 minutes at one stage on the way to a town just outside of Granada. Again, the backdrop was glorious. We had sort of the Sierra Nevada snow-capped in the background. And they were allowed to win by about 54, 55 seconds in the end. Ivan Bromeo won that. And then with the stage remaining, it was always going to be difficult. No time trial either to take the jersey back. We had another couple of sprints. Fretin won one of them. And the other one would have been won by, I'm trying to remember now. Younger Tom Krabbe did it again, didn't he, for Flanders Baloise. That was a fantastic win against the likes of Søren Varenschold. And the final stage, the gap was just realistically too big, 50-odd seconds. To do something. Leknesen couldn't really try and get his 7 seconds back either because Romeo and Movistar rode brilliantly. Pidcock did win the last stage with a really strong attack, and it was enough to get him onto the GC podium. That, by the way, was Pinarello's first win of the season. So they'd been sort of scratching around for a victory, so that was good for them.
But yeah, they've been strong. They've looked strong. Tom Glogue, we didn't mention in Algarve. He was fifth overall in Algarve, and he's looked really good.
Yeah. I mean, was he part of that training camp in Chile or not?
I think so.
But yeah, they got their victory. But no, it was always going to be too difficult. And the sort of the big moment of the race happened when we weren't expecting it, which was basically just letting the breakaway get those 3-4 minutes on stage two. Strange old race, looked good. But again, not really a headline-making race compared to what we've just been talking about.
A case of Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo, on stage two then? I thought Fred Wright rode well. I thought Pinarello Q36.5 did really well on that last stage. It was obvious what they were doing. They were trying to set Tom Pidcock up for the move on over those last little climbs. And I agree with you, Rob. I mean, it does make you think that get away from the coast down there on the south of Spain, and the inland towns and villages are absolutely stunning, all the sort of whitewashed buildings and the countryside, especially at this time of year. Not really my cup of tea in the baking heat of summer, but it's on my list for sort of winter break next year, perhaps.
Chaps, I said we get to Marc Soler of UAE. Some news not strictly relating to racing, but a couple of weeks ago we talked about this story, this breaking story about his father, Jaume, having been suspended by the Spanish Anti-Doping Agency for association with a banned individual. And that individual is Pepe Martí, a coach involved in the US Postal USADA investigation long time ago. In fact, he was banned, Pepe Martí, for 15 years. That sentence is coming to its end now. However, Jaume Soler, Marc Soler's father, was reported by the Escape Collective, our friends there, to have got an 18-month ban from Spanish Anti-Doping Agency because he was being coached by Pepe Martí. Now, Spanish website Ciclo 21 has given a lot more, reported a lot more information about this in recent days. Information that sort of, well, it shines a bit more of a light on Marc Soler himself. They have talked about a meeting that took place on August the 9th, 2023, near Andorra. And the three individuals, Pepe Martí, Jaume Soler, and Marc Soler, the rider, were under surveillance, and they did meet up, and there was equipment seized by the Guardia Civil. It was innocuous equipment. It was the sort of equipment you would use for a normal lactate test. And when they subsequently were called to give evidence to the three parties, Jaume Soler said that this was equipment, well, he was doing the test despite that day not having been in cycling clothing. Marc also said that, and Marc said he's not coached by Pepe Martí. However, another interesting detail in the Ciclo 21 report was that the police had seen Marc Soler allegedly approaching where they had sort of set up a check, and he had kind of turned around three times to apparently try to avoid this check. Again, this is according to a report in Ciclo 21. What happens now? Well, we don't know the extent of any ongoing investigation by the Spanish Anti-Doping Agency into Marc himself. However, what could happen? Well, and the reason his dad was sanctioned is this WADA code, Article 2.10, which is about prohibited association. So there are there's a list on the WADA website of individuals who you cannot associate with as a professional athlete. Now, a couple of provisos to that. Yeah, you have to know that they are prohibited. However, as I said, the list is there on the WADA website. So it's kind of taken as read most of the time that the athlete does know or should know such an individual is ineligible. And the second proviso is that it has to be real training. You can't just come into contact. You can't just meet this person, I don't know, for a bacon butty a glass of wine. They have to be coaching you. As I said, we don't know whether Marc could face repercussions for this. And I guess we will probably find out in due course. What is the potential risk? Well, his father received 18-month ban. The risk for Marc is higher. The standard WADA sanction is 2 years, which can be increased to 4 years if there are aggravating circumstances. And anti-doping authorities often hold world tour professionals to a higher standard than master or amateur athletes, which is what Jaume Soler is. So slightly concerning. We said a couple of weeks ago that UAE hadn't made any statement about this, and we didn't necessarily think they needed to make a statement. That may now have changed, or it may change in the coming weeks. As I said, slightly inconclusive, the Ciclo 21 report, but certainly slightly alarming and has raised some eyebrows.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car, the back of the pack, please.
This episode is also sponsored by NordVPN, the best and fastest virtual private network in the world. I've got my laptop on now and I've got NordVPN enabled, as I always do, either on my laptop or phone or tablet. We even have our internet router at home connected up to NordVPN to ensure that all of our internet connections are safe and secure. I think in the past, I was quite blasé about the importance of online security. I kind of thought, well, it'll be okay, won't it? And then I realised gradually that maybe there are some occasions when it won't be okay, and it might be a better idea to ensure that I'm protected. And NordVPN does that. It gives you that peace of mind wherever you are, that your online identity is safe, that your data is protected, and that you're not vulnerable to cyber attacks or phishing attempts or viruses floating around the internet. So NordVPN will offer all Cycling Podcast listeners a great deal at nordvpn.com/TCP. It's risk-free as well, with a 30-day money-back guarantee in the unlikely event that you don't see the benefits of NordVPN, because it's not just about the cybersecurity aspect. There are lots of other benefits too. You can switch your location and potentially save money when you're buying things online, like hotels or holidays or airline tickets. And when you're traveling abroad, you can also switch your location back to your home country and carry on watching your favorite streaming services or sports events as you would at home, especially if they're geo-restricted in some way. So go to nordvpn.com/TCP and get a great NordVPN deal today.
Well, chaps, spring is springing, I think, is in Berlin. Anyway, the temperature's gone up about 15 degrees as of about 3 days ago. And the birds are apparently singing in Belgium. How do we know this? Well, our very faithful reporter, who developed a bit of a cult following, rightly so, last year, on the ground in Belgium, in Flanders, indeed, Hugo Kordowitz, a very long-term cycling correspondent of Het Nieuwsblad. He is going to be returning this year throughout the classics for, again, a lot of people's favourite feature of our classics coverage last year, Kordowitz Corner, in which he'll sort of preview, give us nuggets from Belgium, Flanders, what is being sort of whispered through the back channels behind the scenes of the classics. And, well, Hugo has duly provided his first beautiful scene setter before Saturday's big opener, Omloop Het Nieuwsblad. So it's over to Flanders and over to Kordowitz Corner.
Pay attention, freebie. Playtime is over. Now comes the real work. After a long cold and wet winter, the birds have been singing in full force again in Vlaanderen since Wednesday. Meanwhile, on the worn roads of the Hahoek and Lieberg, you see strange birds passing by at regular intervals in all shapes and sizes. The bigger the team, the more motorcycles swarm around the group during the reckon. Even though cycling has been ridden on every continent in the meantime, with the Omloop Het Nieuwsblad, cycling comes home. It's the first time the big boys are in charge. Controlled robotic cycling is over. In the top Flemish races, the situation sometimes changes so quickly that it becomes even confusing for the team leaders. The Omloop is usually a game of speed chess once the Molenberger looms. By incorporating the Ten Bossen and Parijkenberg after the Berendries, this Omloop Het Nieuwsblad resembles the old Ronde van Vlaanderen even more closely than in previous years. When you think of the Ronde van Vlaanderen, you think of Mathieu van der Poel. He will be riding the Omloop for the first time in his career. This would mean a Van der Poel Van Aert jubel, a premiere in the very first of the Flemish cobbled classics. No one knows how fit Wout van Aert is after his ankle surgery, except for himself and his team. In the past, Het Nieuwsblad has often been a fast-paced race. With Van der Poel in the mix, the Omloop's physiognomy could change. The 8-time cyclocross world champion doesn't do things halfway. It's quite possible that this aperitif to the April Classics will see the first duel of the season, with riders like Pidcock, Van Baarle and Stuyven as allies. And if he can't stay ahead, Van der Poel still has Philipsen in reserve. And Van Aert has both Laporte and Brennan. The Ballerinis, De Lies, Magnies, Girmais and Verenschals of this world must hope it's a repeat of last year. But honestly, I don't think the chances of winning this time with unshaved legs are great.
Well, chaps, if that doesn't get you excited and well, feeling very Belgian, then I don't know what will.
Oh, that's made my spring, and it's not even started yet, Daniel. I mean, at least I got a preview of that yesterday when you
sent a shiver up your spine.
You sent it to me when I was walking down the street, supermarket, and I had a spring in my step just going down every aisle. I was looking for Belgian beers. I was looking for all sorts of stuff. I bought myself a nice big steak. I even made my own frites last night. It's time to go. We're ready. And I've just seen the start list as well. Everyone's there. Brilliant.
His voice is a combination of the smells of Flanders in spring, isn't it? You know, it's the cigarette smoke in Hugo's case, literally. And when I think of Flanders, I think of sort of you get the cigarette smoke and you get the freshly spread dung manure on the Flandrian fields as they've just been sort of churned up, ready for planting, I guess, in the springtime. It feels like the beginning of something, and it is literally the beginning of the classic season, isn't it? One point of order, though. We're going to have to get used to calling it Omloop Nieuwsblad because the official branding...
No, that's not happening.
Branding is that they dropped the het last year, and I don't like it. I still think of it as Omloop Het Nieuwsblad, so I don't think there should be any sort of sanctions for us if we call it by its proper name. I mean, really, we should still call it Omloop Het Volk after the old newspaper that got sort of merged into Het Nieuwsblad. But there we are. It's the race,
more,
isn't it?
More absolute woke nonsense in cycling.
But as you say, Rob, the big story is that Mathieu van der Poel is going to make his season's debut on the road and, in fact, his debut at Omloop Het Nieuwsblad. He's never ridden before, and that's a real kind of boost for the profile of the race, really, isn't it? And it gives Alpecin Premier Tech, you know, a real sort of, well, I think a three-pronged attack, really. They've got a couple of sprinters, Jasper Philipsen and Caden Groves, and now Mathieu van der Poel. And I think the most interesting thing about the race this year is that the insertion of the 10 Bos climb in the finale before you get to the Muir in Hellasberg and then the Bosberg, that sort of traditional old Tour Flanders finish. The insertion of 10 Bos, I think they've done that because in recent years there have been some big groups arriving at the finish of Het Nieuwsblad, and really it shouldn't be that kind of race. I don't think it shouldn't come down to 45 or 50 riders as it has done. Last year was a 50 up sprint, wasn't it, won by Soren Wellenskold of Uno X ahead of Paul Manier, as we mentioned earlier. Previous to that, you know, we've seen a couple of riders get away and then a big chase group behind, sort of 30, 35 riders. This trend is something that I think the organisers are keen to reverse. And so inserting another climb, 10 Bos Straat, which in itself is not that mega hard, but it's got a dead turn at the bottom, hasn't it, Rob? And it will slow everyone down, and it will really put the emphasis on positioning into that finale. And it might mean that it won't all just concertina up together again after the Muir in Hellasberg and then the Bosberg, and then we see that kind of quite tentative sprint type finish. So it could well be that we see a bit more of an open race in that final 30-40 kilometres than we have in recent years. So it's all really up for grabs, and I think the involvement of Mathieu van der Poel after his such a dominant cyclocross season, he's obviously going to have good legs. The question will be whether he tries to go for a flyer, whether this is really a target for him, or whether it's just an opportunity to ride, you know, with the bigger races to come in April.
There are two major spring cobbled races that Mathieu van der Poel hasn't won. One is the Omloop Het Nieuwsblad, and the other is Gent-Wevelgem. So this is obviously some sort of target for him. Yeah, I don't think he's going to break his season if he doesn't win on Saturday, but it's something I think he'd probably like to add to the palmarès. And you talk about maybe it breaking up earlier on. I'm looking down at the start list, and there are so many big hitters that anything could happen in this race. I would say much more of a strong start list than we've had in the last few years, because we've often had a few people missing this race. I mean, Cancellara used to famously miss this race, didn't he? He used to sit down and watch it on the settee with his sports director, Derek de Mon. They'd be on the phone and they'd be talking about everybody else and how they were getting on. Where they had others who tried to win this throughout their careers and never succeeded. Tom Bonan never managed to win the Unlocked Nieuwsblad, for example. But I'm looking down, Pidcock, Van der Poel, there's Fanat, there's Binyam Girmay, Jasper Philipsen, Paul Magnier, Arnaud Dely, even people like Jonas Abrahamsson racing and turning up as well. Tim Wellens, loads of people who could win in different ways. And yes, there is Tim Bosser, there's Paddy Cobberg as well, but let's not forget the new identity, really, of this race is Hagoek-Leyberg. And those combinations give you a real early opportunity to break up that race. The only doubt doing that then is how do you get from the Beerenries to the Moor? If there's another climb in between that now, it's no longer that big, long road all the way into the Moor where if you make the difference, it can come back together again. So I think, yes, partly the organisers, partly the start list could see a real sort of aggressive race opening up from a long way to go.
Just one bit of breaking news though, Rob. Wout van Aert not riding on Saturday. He had that crash in the cyclocross, I think. Did he fracture his ankle? Or did he have it? Quite a serious injury, wasn't it?
He's had surgery on his ankle.
He was due to ride, but illness in the last few days, and I think that's been confirmed this morning as we're recording. So no Wout van Aert, but as you say, you know, there's riders who are in banging form. You know, Tom Pidcock as well for Pinarello Q36.5. You can pick out lots of riders. I mean, the one sort of real interesting story is the kind of the rebirth of Soudal Quickstep as a classics team. They're pivoting back that direction. And I was really impressed with how Dylan Van Baarle was climbing in Algarve, especially on that last day. I mean, he was hanging on to the coattails of that Ayuso Sexas Only train until very, very late up that final climb. So climbing very well. And I think the great thing about Omloop Het Nieuwsblad is that it's a real anything goes race. I mean, I was looking back at what previous winners have done in their run up to the race, and we've had all sorts. We've had, well, when Van Aert won it in 2022 and when Van Baarle won it in 2023, it was their first race of the season. So the precedent is there for Van der Poel that you can come straight in and win. You know, go further back, Ian Stannard rode the Tour Down Under and the Tour of Qatar, which obviously doesn't exist anymore, Qatar race, before he won those back-to-back editions in 2014 and 15. So, you know, we could be looking at riders who've done the Tour Down Under. Michael Valgren went that route as well. Philippe Gilbert back in the day as well. But really, there's no indicators from the early races other than people who are showing those first signs of form, like the sort of spring daffodils. Anyone who's going well in the last week or two is going to be a factor in the race. It's much more a race about form than it is about kind of pedigree, I'd say.
I'm just looking down the list. We could just do a whole podcast reading off the start list. It's that exciting. There is one thing to mention though. We mention it every year because it still happens every year. If you win Le Omloop Nieuwsblad, you don't necessarily win the Ronde van Vlaanderen. Still, nobody ever has won the Omloop Het Nieuwsblad and the Ronde van Vlaanderen in the same season. So maybe, like everything, that's a stat waiting to be broken.
So you don't necessarily in the true sense of the word, you definitely don't win Tour of Flanders. Chaps, many illustrious former winners of this race, of course. You go back through the Palmares. I mean, Rob, you've mentioned a couple who haven't won this race. Go back to 2009. There was a new team on the block. We didn't have the World Tour there. We had something similar. But new team on the block. They were a Pro Continental Division team at the time. Cervelo Test Team. Team that a lot of people remember with some fondness, I would say. And Omloop Het Nieuwsblad, or was it Het Volk in 2009? I'm not sure. That was their second ever victory. Their first was at the Tour of Qatar. That was Roger Hammond in the first weeks of their existence. And shortly thereafter, they took a big prize in Omloop with Het Hushovd. Herr Hushovd, Tor Hushovd, the big Norwegian. Now, earlier this week, I caught up with Tor, spoke to him about the team's hopes and ambitions for Het Nieuwsblad, his victory in 2009, but also another story that's sort of blown up the internet in the last few days, and that is this sort of rumour about one of the big stars, probably the big star on the men's side in the Winter Olympics, a gentleman called Johannes Klæbo, a 29-year-old Norwegian, who swept the board in all of the cross-country skiing events. Clips of him in action went viral everywhere. You'll have seen them, this extraordinary technique, just sort of eating up the ground. I read in L'Equipe earlier this week that the French cross-country skiers have been calling him the Pogacar of cross-country skiing. Well, anyway, Johannes Klæbo is a bit of a cyclist in his spare time, and Jim Cotton, our friend from Velo, reported that he's had contact with Hushovd and the Uno X team before. He's ridden with them, I think, before the Tour of Flanders on a couple of occasions, and there have even been the suggestions that he might one day join the team. Tor Hushovd himself has been quoted as saying in the past, he sits beautifully on the bike, has great control. With the engine he's got, he could succeed in almost any endurance sport. And Klæbo is also quoted as having said, I need to do the Olympics first, then we'll see. After the Olympics, I'll start thinking about what I'll do next. So maybe joining the Uno X team should be the next goal. So, it fell to me to ask Tor, as I said, about Omloop this year in 2009, but also about these Johannes Klæbo rumours. Let's find out what's really going on.
Good question. I think when you win 6-time Olympic gold medal, I guess that you create a value of what you're doing. And also, I think when you're that good at something, why risk it to also move out from the sport? So I think it's a long way for him to get into the professional cycling at the age of almost 30. But I would love to. I mean, if he would like to give it a try, the Unix team is ready.
Okay, because he said, there's a quote here, after the Olympics, I'll start thinking about what I'll do next, so maybe joining Uno X should be the next goal. I mean, have there been any conversations recently?
I know Johannes, so I sent him a message and congratulate him, and, he's been to Tour de France the last couple of years, he's been to us with Tour of Flanders, but there is not a conversation regarding a contract going on. This I can confirm.
Not regarding a contract. That sounds intriguing. It sounds as though there's something else you maybe can't say. There might be some sort of trial or lab test or something in the works.
No, but it's a sportsman and a personality you would like to work with at some point or to do something with. The way he prepared the world champion, also the world championship at the Olympics, it's extraordinary, and I think most people have something to learn because he do things to the extreme. He's been away on training camps. He's not hugging his girlfriend the last weeks before the Olympics. Without that I'm knowing all the details, but that's what I've been reading in Norwegian newspapers. Take it to the next level. I think many have something to learn from that.
So the most extraordinary thing about him, as well as the way he looks when he's skiing, is how versatile he is. And it's kind of the equivalent, I don't know if you would agree, whether it's the equivalent of someone winning bunch sprints in cycling, but also winning mountain stages of the Tour, or whether it's the equivalent of someone who's successful on the track but also on the road. But in terms of versatility, in terms of being able to become a professional cyclist, obviously you mentioned his age, 29. People will always say, well, you need to have developed certain skills by that age to have any chance. What do you think?
Yeah. No, it's like, I think you have to see it on different angles, because if you put him on a bike and give him a few months, he will drop many riders in the peloton up a climb. The thing is, when you haven't been riding the bike, you know, since you were young or over the last years in a peloton, with the speed the peloton goes, with the fight for positions, you know, things like this would be his big challenge. Even though he's very good on the bike in terms of bike handling and stuff like this, but it's a different from doing that to. To fighting in with 200 guys in a peloton.
So to conclude, you wouldn't rule it out. It's not impossible, but nothing, absolutely nothing is happening at the moment.
Yeah, that's right. That's
okay.
Right.
Okay.
And I mean, if he would call me back now and say I would like to try, I would do everything I can to look into this because it's a nice project. And he mentioned that all Norwegians, because we are almost all Norwegians, they love skiing, and especially now they love Klæbu.
Yeah,
they would like to follow his project.
If he calls you now, he'll be in the team for Omloop on Saturday. If he calls you now on Thursday afternoon.
Exactly.
Tor, you just made me curious. Obviously we know you've got a coach now, Olaf Alexander Bu, and there was a sort of similar story about Christian Blumenfeld for a while, these rumours about him becoming a professional road cyclist, maybe even trying to win the Tour de France. And the team that he was most strongly linked was Jayco Lula. Has there been any suggestion that he might also get a shot at riding for your team?
No, because I think he still would like to go on do his triathlon and... that was also a nice project, but that's a no.
Okay. Two last things, because it is Omloop at the weekend. First, I want to know how your team is looking, particularly excited about Abrahamsen at the weekend. What do you expect from him?
No, I mean, he's looking good. The whole team looks strong. Jonas, he's been training like crazy over the winter. So he just, he is now a human being with a lot of energy. He will like to get out of the body with a start number on the back. So he will be interesting to follow on Saturday.
Your memories of 2009 when you won Omloop.
Yeah, that was kind of the I don't know if it was the first victory.
Second,
it was, but second victory. Okay, yeah. But it made kind of the first mark that we were a young or new team. Actually, first season was up there in the classics, and personally for myself there was also a nice victory, but it was the first race in the first classic of the team, and from that moment we almost we did well in all of them.
Okay, Tor, you're not signing Ingebrigtsen either? No?
He's... I'm running a cycling team.
No, but you know, with his Achilles injury, I don't know, cycling could be perfect for rehab. You could have Klæbu, Ingebrigtsen, Blumenfeld at the Tour next year.
Oh, that would be nice. No, I think at the moment we have a lot of good, strong riders on the team, and we focus on that.
Okay.
So, chaps, Johannes Klæbu will not be winning Omloop Het Nieuwsblad or Omloop Nieuwsblad this year, but who knows in the future? Do you want to make any predictions, chaps? I think I will predict Matthew Brennan or Paul Meunier. I'm expecting, although I have heard the forecast is for a tailwind, which should lend itself to attacking racing. And although Hugo, and I can't remember whether Hugo's or what Hugo's record as a soothsayer last year was, he did occasionally offer the odd prediction. I can't remember whether they were generally good predictions or dud predictions, but he sort of suggested he doesn't think Vanderpool will win the weekend. I think they've got a perfect setup there. They've got the perfect sort of two options or maybe three options. Vanderpool's kind of the free card that they can play. And if it all comes back together, then they've got Groves or Philipsen. Philipsen has not looked great in sprints so far, but I think that between them, those Alpecin boys will probably pull something out. So one of those boys or Brennan would be my bets. Or Meunier.
Anyone else? You'd be like that guy who's going to be just standing outside.
Abrahamson, actually, Abrahamson as well. I fancy. I unfortunately must confess, Your Honour, that I have been heavily influenced by his Instagram stories over the last few weeks, and I can't believe that anyone is gonna beat this incredible Hulk that's been sort of incubated in the Sierra Nevada for the last few weeks.
I mean, there are two teams for whom the pressure is ramping up already. We're only a month and a bit into the season, but EF Education and Picnic Post, both without a win of any kind yet. There's about, I think it's 7 or 8 teams that don't yet have a World Tour win, but EF and Picnic are, Picnic need to tuck into the Scotch eggs and pork pies, don't they, and get themselves up the road a bit. And looking at their riders on the provisional start list, wouldn't necessarily think it's going to be a big day for them this weekend. Because I think the might of Sudal Quickstep, they've got numbers as well. Alpecin, they've got numbers. And as you say, Daniel, I think the real kind of wild card is Matthew Brennan, just because of, you know, if it's a small group, he'll could still be there. The absence of Van Aert makes their tactics a bit simpler. Christophe Laporte is in there if it comes down to a real kind of big group sprint, but I suspect the finale might be a little bit different. Although if you say tailwind tends to make it hard for people to get away in small groups, doesn't it? It tends to keep the groups together a bit. But I think that's the beauty of Omloop Nieuwsblad. I'll do the marketing man's job for them, give it its proper name. The beauty is it's one of the very few races where there's every possibility and there is a form guide, but really anything can happen. Anything can happen on the opening day of the classic season. And it kind of sets the tempo then, and it raises and dampens expectations for the bigger races that come through the second half of March and into April. We'll know a lot more on Monday morning, which is when we will recap these races. Because, of course, there's the Donkey Derby on Sunday as well, Kerner Brussels Kerner.
I mean, I don't know where to go with predictions here, boys. I'm not particularly good at it anyway. I will, though, flag another name that we've not mentioned yet and one that I'm really looking forward to watching this spring. He finished the season brilliantly last year. He hasn't ridden yet this year. He talked about 19-year-old superstars in the making in Paul Sixas. There's another one on Needle Trek, and he's going to get a bit more of an opportunity, I think, this spring because of the injury to Mads Pedersen. I'm talking about Albert Witten, their young 19-year-old Dane. He was on the podium in Tre Valli Varesine. We know how difficult that is of a race with the climbing. Yes, there's no cobbles in it, but he also then finished on the podium in Paris-Tours, which now has all of these sort of chemin, these little sort of vineyard off-road sections in. I'm really looking forward to see how he gets on. I'm by no means tipping him for the win, but I think it'd be interesting to see how he gets on with a bit more freedom. Obviously, another man who's going to enjoy that freedom is someone like Vatsek, I think, as well in that team. So not too much attention on Needle Trek, given the absence of Mads Pedersen, the fact that Jasper Stuyven's now moved on. But I'm looking forward to watching them at the weekend.
Okay, chaps. Well, I think that just about does it. Rob, I'm going to tip you to get a haircut in the next couple of hours. I know that's what your plans are for later in the day. Just on EF Education first, actually, Lionel, I probably shouldn't tease this because it hasn't happened yet, but it's supposed to also happen on Monday. As a sort of footnote to our series on promotion and relegation last year, I'm going to have a heated debate with Tom Southam, who is a direct sportif at Education. He's EF Education. Easy Post. EF Education First, Easy Post. We're going to have a heated debate about the UCI rankings because he's not a big fan of the UCI ranking system, promotion relegation in their current form. And I am increasingly, by the hour, I become more in favour of it. So we're going to have a heated debate and he's going to outline his arguments and I am going to shoot them down. Anyway, So that's coming for Friends of the Podcast next week, hopefully. Should happen on Monday. Anyway, chaps, and we'll be back to sum up Omloop Nieuwsblad on Monday as well at some point. Lionel, is that right?
Well, I think so. I think we need to strike while the iron is hot on Monday and all the action is still fresh in our memories. So, yeah, we'll record that on Monday and that will be available on sort of Monday early evening, I guess. So listen out for that one.
Thank you very much.
Ciao.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.